Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual serving of two guests today. First, in a few minutes, Jennifer Silva will talk about her research into the consciousness of younger working-class adults. And then towards the bottom of the hour, economist Heidi Shierholz will explain what has and hasn't been driving trends towards increased wage inequality since the 1970s. Back in a previous life, when I was studying poetry and critical theory, I was very interested in the relations between individual psychology and larger social structures. I set that interest aside for a while as I tried to understand political economy, but I've been returning to that old interest, one angle of which is what some writers have called the neoliberal self, the kind of personality and outlook that's been shaped by the last three decades of hypercapitalism. So when I heard about Jennifer Silva's new book, Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty, just out from Oxford University Press, I knew I had to read the book and interview her. Silva is a sociologist, currently with a postdoc at Harvard, who interviewed about 100 working-class men and women in their 20s and early 30s to understand how they think and feel about the intensely unstable and challenging economic world they live in. Not to spoil the suspense, but that world has created a hardened, distrustful, self-reliant sensibility, one to which solidarity and commitment are strange ideas. Here is Jennifer Silva to explain. Welcome, Jennifer Silva. First of all, let's set your own background. You grew up working class in Lowell?
No, I actually grew up in a suburb. My father was born in Lowell, but then his father got a job as a prison guard in the suburb of Concord, Massachusetts, and kind of moved the family out of Lowell.
But are you the first in your family to pursue a professional career?
I am. I was the first one in my family to graduate from college, and then I went on to graduate school.
Okay, now let's describe your research. How did you do it? Who did you talk to?
So I became very interested in the question of what it means to grow up today. And the media generally portray young people today as entitled and narcissistic and not working as hard as generations before them. But I wanted to sort of get a more complicated picture of, you know, young working class adults who might not have the kinds of resources or education or family connections or support to help them, you know, establish a stable adult life.
Now let's pause a second before this media picture of these shiftless young adults. Are they talking about the same universe of people you are, or are they talking about a different class of kids, or where do they get this idea from?
No, I think in general, when the kind of popular media talks about the millennial generation, as they call them, they're thinking about the sort of entitled young adults who might, you know, take a year off after college and travel the world, or who, you know, might do unpaid internships, or who bounce from job to job trying to find their passion. So I don't think in general there's much of a discussion about social class issues and about how, for, you know, lots of young adults, the resources to kind of build this life through internships or through someone paying for college, they just don't exist.
Okay, so back to your research.
So starting in 2008, I went out into the communities of Lowell, Massachusetts, and Richmond, Virginia, sort of two deindustrializing cities where, you know, good blue-collar jobs have really disappeared. And so I went to places like service sector workplaces like Walmarts and coffee shops and fast food chains and community colleges, looking for young people in their 20s and early 30s and asking them, what does it mean to grow up? What kinds of obstacles do you face as you try to get ahead in life? And, you know, what is your hope for the future? Do you still believe in the American dream?
Okay, and there are, of course, many dimensions of the answers to these questions, so let's look at some of them. Just to set the stage, they live in a labor market that is just extremely unstable, right? They just have no expectations of stability or prosperity or upward mobility.
That's right. They actually learn very quickly not to expect any loyalty from their jobs. They don't expect to even be able to get enough hours. You know, one young woman said, basically, you worship the ground your employer walks on because they gave you a job and you really don't think you can demand anything else.
And this, instead of promoting resentment or solidarity, seems to induce a deep sense of self-reliance.
That's right. And I think it's because of the many interactions that these young men and women have that foster a sense of distrust in institutions and in other people. So, for example, young people will grow up knowing that they should go to college if they want a secure future. And then they get to college and they have so much trouble figuring out how to fulfill requirements, how to fill out the FAFSA, how to choose a major that will get them a professional job.
It's interesting, you know, the panacea is supposed to be education, but the way you describe it, they have a hard time navigating even getting into a college. And then once there and maybe once out, they don't really know what to do with it.
That's right. It's sort of they don't know how to use it. They don't understand the rules of the game. So, you know, one young man I spoke with had a degree in communications that took him 7 years to finish, and he had no idea really how he would ever use a communications major to get a job. And he said, you know, I always thought I'd wear a suit, but he didn't really have more of a vision than that.
Okay, so education doesn't really do the trick for them. They can get a degree from a community college or even a four-year college and then find themselves working at Starbucks.
That's right. And for, you know, a few of them, you know, maybe if they knew someone, for example, if they had an aunt who was a nurse, maybe they could say, oh, okay, I see, you can become a nurse. And they'd kind of have this pathway to follow. But for most of them, as the first one in their family to pursue higher education and without really any mentors or community support or help, they just had no idea how to use a degree or how to even, you know, take the right classes to get the degree and how to pay for it.
In a couple of cases, though, kids who are exposed to some people from up the class ladder were able to navigate things a little better than those who did not have that experience.
That's right. For example, one man, his mother remarried, and his stepdad was from a much more middle-class background and could help him get that knowledge, sort of insider knowledge he needed in order to get a good professional job. But most of these young people, like, you know, they grow up in communities and neighborhoods and schools where they don't have these ties, so they really do feel like they're on their own.
The sensibility of many of the working class people you talk to, including the men, was a world different from the classic man of few words, tough old guy of working class lore of the 50s and 60s.
You know, that's right. I was sort of expecting a much more stoic kind of working class, especially men. But instead, the men and women I spoke with, the vast majority of them, they wanted to talk about their emotions. They wanted to talk about their difficult tasks and, you know, their struggles, whether to heal relationships with their families, or maybe they were struggling with a mental illness or a drug addiction or a, you know, past of painful romantic relationships. But when I wanted to talk to them about growing up, they really focused on these kind of emotional or psychological struggles.
And where did they get this language from?
You know, it's really everywhere. They listed many different sources, whether, you know, they read self-help books. For example, one woman who said the education system failed her because it never realized she had ADHD, had turned to reading self-help books to try to fix her ADHD so she might be able to go to college someday. They watch talk shows. They learn this language of self-help and emotional well-being through, you know, school psychologists. They learn it in the foster care system, in the, you know, criminal justice system, in the medical field, if they enroll in free drug trials to try to get help for their mental problems or their even physical problems. So they're kind of bombarded with this language of sort of, you can heal yourself. You should, if you're, you know, unhappy with your life, it's up to you to fix it.
Yeah, at the same time, there's this kind of New Agey, Oprah-ish quality to the discourse. You also describe a real hardening of the self. How do these fit together?
That's right. It's sort of this idea of it's my responsibility to fix myself. And looking at other people who can't fix themselves with disdain and almost disgust. So they sort of think, if you're a worthy person, not only should you be able to get a job and support yourself, but you should also be able to overcome your emotional problems. By sheer will, you know, it's sort of up to you to fix your wounded emotional self as well.
You describe this scene in a fairly comfortable looking house, but the principal breadwinner was a contractor who was facing trouble in the 2008 bust. And on the 64-inch TV comes the story on Fox of the complaints about CEO pay, and then Obama comes on the screen talking about universal health care, and the family's reaction was extremely interesting. So can you talk about that?
That's right. That was a very fascinating time. I was sitting and watching television with this family, and for this family who has sort of a history of feeling like they've been betrayed by institutions and especially government, whether through, you know, very high taxes. They really see freedom as the lack of government intervention in their lives. So this idea that they would be forced to have health care, and they don't have health care, anyone in the family, just feels to them like such an assault on their personal freedom. And the same thing about if CEO bonuses were to be limited, they feel like that's unfair. They feel like the market should be left alone and, you know, everyone should have the chance to make millions of dollars.
They resent and feel betrayed by institutions like the schools and the state, but they don't feel that way about the market. Why is that?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think it's part of it is because they at one point felt like they had a social contract with institutions such as schools. You know, people tell them in school, you can make it. We believe in you. You know, you can go to college and make something of yourself. And then they kind of learn very quickly that's not the case. You know, maybe they'll get an associate's degree but still be working at Target. And so I think that there is a sense of betrayal in their everyday lives through these institutions. Whereas in the labor market, in the job market, it's different. It's sort of the sense that everybody should have the chance to, you know, get rich however they need to do it. And, you know, they kind of make a virtue out of everyone just going it alone and doing it on their own.
But is the market seen as some sort of realm of nature that is not an institution?
Yeah, it's some kind of, it's seen as impersonal. The making of money is seen as impersonal versus, you know, the educational sphere or the government, which seems to be made of, you know, people who will let you down.
So they really have no sense of social solidarity or of a political approach to their problems.
No, they really don't. It's the sense that you can't really trust people. One woman said, you know, the world judges you guilty until proven innocent. And so it makes them not really want to invest in other people. They learn that if they depend on other people or put their fates in other people's hands, they often get hurt in the end. And so it seems much safer to reject solidarity and to just go it alone.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Silva, author of Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty, just out from Oxford University Press. Now, race is a significant subtext throughout your book. First of all, a lot of the white people you talk to really resent what they see as the alleged advantage that black folks have in the labor market.
That's right. There is some resentment. And part of it goes back to the sense of the broken social contract where these white working class people feel like they're not getting help they need from educational system or from the government. And they say, well, look at these African-American people who, you know, play basketball all day and don't work hard and they get help. And so they kind of rely on these stereotypes and say, look, other people are getting help and I'm not. And that's not fair. And, you know, because they feel like being able to make it on your own is what makes you a worthy person, they draw these very strong boundaries, racial boundaries against African-Americans who they think take government help. But, you know, what's really, really interesting is that at the same time people say, oh, I don't see race. Race doesn't matter. Race is more of a mindset. Like, they don't want to believe it really exists as a social structure.
It's as if everything is a mindset and material reality takes a deep back seat.
That's right. And that black men and women I spoke with, you know, they'd say, people use race as a crutch, but I can't. I won't ever admit that my race would keep me from getting a job because it's up to me to, you know, learn how to dress right and learn how to talk right and navigate that system on my own.
And they would often narrate experiences of, very personal experiences of racism, yet not draw the conclusion that they were somehow suffering from racism.
That's right. One young man I was speaking with, a black young man at a community college, halfway through the interview, he looked at me and he said, you know, as a white woman, if we passed each other on the street, you wouldn't even look me in the eye. You know, but now you're talking to me because you want something. So he's very aware of how race, you know, inhibits his life chances. But at the same time, he won't say that affects his outcomes because he believes that he's in charge 100% of his fate. So it's sort of navigating racism becomes this kind of game, individual game, where it's his responsibility to do it. And he doesn't want to think about it as a social problem.
The military plays an important role in a lot of your interview subjects' lives. So what is that?
Yeah, so the military is sort of often seen as kind of the last chance to make something of their lives and seen as a vehicle for upward mobility. So for young men and women who graduate high school and don't really know what to do with themselves, the military kind of gives them the sense of routine and gives them a structure and, you know, offers benefits like free education or maybe help with a mortgage that is, you know, really attractive to them as a promise of a middle-class life. It doesn't always work out that way. Part of, you know, most of the young men and women I spoke with had been deployed several times, and that often meant they had to leave their young children. And so there was this tension between wanting to give their children a better life but having to leave them for 18 months at a time. And at the same time, you know, navigating the benefits of the military, kids are also very complicated. So having enough time to try to go to school for free, but also navigating the, you know, bureaucracy of getting your checks and being able to buy your books on time, that really didn't work out for people. And so that ended up being kind of another site of betrayal.
Yeah, I mean, this sense of not being able to navigate comes up again and again. It's as if, you know, they're expected to be self-reliant in a world they don't really understand and don't know how to play.
That's right. It's like they just don't have the common sense knowledge for just everyday making decisions and making choices. And so making good decisions that will invest in their futures is very difficult because they don't really know what risks that they should take and what risks they shouldn't take. So, for example, one woman bought a house that she thought was a great investment and kind of didn't understand the 13.75 interest rate, you know, and the house ends up being foreclosed on and setting her back even more. So it's like they just don't really have someone to help them figure out the risks that they should take or shouldn't take, or just, you know, how to do what we might think of as simple things like, you know, register for classes or, you know, make a phone call to an institution and demand something.
And debt is a constant in their unstable lives.
That's right. And that's partly because they use their credit cards as a way to deal with, you know, emergencies. Like one woman, you know, fell and cut her head and put the $4,000 on her credit card because she didn't have health insurance and didn't have savings. So, you know, the credit card becomes like their one safety net. And for some of them, it gets to the point where they don't even want to look at the bills because it's so overwhelming to them.
And then some of what you call, you know, the milestones, not just you, but, you know, the milestones of growing up, marriage, kids, that sort of thing. A lot of them are a little shy about doing those things.
Commitment is understood as sort of a risky venture for these young men and women because they're afraid of investing time and energy and emotions into something that, you know, they think will most likely fail. Many of them have grown up in families that were fairly fragile or chaotic, and they're afraid to kind of end up like their own families. And at the same time, they worry that they can't meet their expectations of what a good relationship is. So for men, the fact that they, you know, don't have very good jobs and can barely support themselves makes it really hard to think about supporting a woman or even being able to take a woman out to dinner. And so these ideas of masculinity as providing for women have persisted, even though the good jobs for men have disappeared. And for women, I think there is also a lot of fear. You know, in some ways, women expect a lot more from relationships than they used to. They want to feel empowered. They want communication. They want a chance to sort of have a relationship be very fulfilling, and they don't really think that they'll meet anyone who can give them that, and they say, well, maybe I'm just better off alone, taking care of myself.
Well, this idea, too, of a kind of therapeutic, biological relationship that's constantly under negotiation is something it requires a lot more resources to manage than a lot of these folks have.
That's right. You know, being a good relationship is not just a relationship that lasts 30 or 40 years. It's one where it's so much communication about what people want and what they, you know, how they want to accomplish their goals and what vision they have for their relationship, you know, and over the years. And it just takes a lot of, like, emotional energy. It takes a lot of time. It might even take, you know, visits to a therapist or being able to go on vacation to renew commitment. And it's just these kinds of demands are very difficult when, you know, both partners are working in unstable jobs and hours, and there's just the stress of even, you know, paying a monthly bill.
Did you find a nostalgia for, you know, classic gender roles and the classic marriage among your interviewees?
Yeah, it was very interesting to hear, you know, 25-year-old men saying, oh, I always wanted to be growing old with my wife, you know, sitting on the porch in a rocking chair, listening to the Dick Van Dyke Show. Just like incredibly nostalgic images for a past that these young men and women certainly didn't ever know. But it's like they have this idea that there used to be love and trust. But they'd say, you know, love and trust are gone now. And for women sometimes, you know, they'd say, like, I don't want to be a feminist. I wish I could just be at home being supported by a man. And I think that's because they feel so insecure and unstable in their own lives that it kind of sparks this nostalgia to be taken care of.
And there are a handful of male firefighters you talked with who seem to kind of inhabit an emotional space of their own.
Yeah, that's right. So the men who had these more traditional masculine jobs tended to be much less likely to talk about their emotions and feelings and to be much more focused on kind of more traditional markers of adulthood, like I got the good job, I bought my house, I got married, now I'm taking care of my kid. And so for these men, you know, they don't have college degrees, but they're in one of the few remaining jobs that, you know, gives them good benefits and a family wage and a pension plan. So they're kind of able to think about a more traditional adulthood. So for these men, like, they didn't, you know, they often had very difficult family lives, but they didn't want to talk about their emotions to me about it. They just kind of wanted to get on with work.
This is a demographic that badly needs social support and solidarity, and the kinds of institutions they seem deeply distrustful of. Yet they seem incapable of thinking about things that way. Is there any way to reconcile that contradiction?
It's a very difficult question. I think it would come down to rebuilding trust in institutions and also thinking about our institutions and how they need to be transformed in order to be transparent and trustworthy. And, you know, part of that might be restoring some kind of, you know, community supports or mentoring for young adults so they don't feel like they're totally on their own making decisions and that they feel like they have people to turn to who actually feel invested in their futures.
The topic of unions came up, I think, only once that I recall. Did you see any interest in them as a way of making folks' lives easier?
There was very little talk of unions. One young man actually said, you know, unions give you a better shot at, you know, fairness in your job. But otherwise, there was very little talk of even the possibility of unions. And I think, again, that probably comes from a lack of trust of other people, but also from just not a very high feeling of self-efficacy when it comes to, you know, organizing or working with other people.
So, as you say, the emotional and psychological world that people live in is very much shaped by their material circumstances. So what has happened to this sense of a working class self over the generations?
So I think that there has been, you know, the decline of, you know, very traditional markers of adulthood, so that they're this idea that you kind of grow up and you can follow your dad to the factory, or, you know, you get married and have a 40 or 50 year relationship and raise children. You know, that's really become impossible, and it's been replaced by, you know, in some ways more freedom, but also a lot more insecurity and instability that makes it really hard to plan for the future, and makes it really hard to trust in other people. And so the self we see is sort of turning inward, you know, because there's not these strong communities, there's not these, you know, long-term jobs, there's no political or union meetings to go to. People feel like they're very much on their own, and they're turning inward and saying, okay, well, if I want to feel like I've made something of myself, I have to do it on my own, and I have to think about how I tell my own story that shows I've done something, because I certainly can't show it by showing that I've graduated from college or gotten a good job.
That was Jennifer Silva, author of Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty, just out from Oxford University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the Divertimento for violin by the Italian composer Giacinto Scelsi, performed by Robert Szymanski. Next up, Heidi Scherholz. Scherholz is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and co-author of a new paper, along with Lawrence Michel and John Schmidt, called Don't Blame the Robots, Assessing the Job Polarization Explanation of Growing Wage Inequality. You can find it on their website, epi.org. The standard explanation, both popular and academic, for increasing wage inequality turns heavily on technology, thus the robots are the paper title, computerization, which allegedly has created a few very good jobs at the top, lots of mundane jobs at the bottom, and only destroyed jobs in between. It's a nice story, but as Heidi Scherholz will tell us, it's not supported by the facts. The real causes are political and institutional, which mainstream types don't like to talk about. That explains the appeal of the technology explanation. It naturalizes the phenomenon and erases class interest and human agency from the picture. I should say that that last bit is my interpretation and not Heidi Scherholz's. Here's Heidi Scherholz. Welcome, Heidi. I think the explanation of polarization that the general public would come up with would be something like, all the good-paying manufacturing jobs have gone to China, and what we have is some people getting nice professional managerial jobs at the top and a lot of people getting crappy jobs at the bottom, and that explains what's been happening with the American labor market. How does that compare with, first of all, what economists have been saying, and second of all, reality?
It's a fine question. This narrative is very strong out there. You hear President Obama saying it, that there's, you know, low-end jobs growing and high-end jobs growing and this hollowing out of the middle, and that's one of the key reasons we have rising wage inequality. So because it's such a powerful public narrative, it's actually useful to dig in and see how much these occupational employment trends really are driving wage trends. So I would say the work that we've done, it has two key parts. First is, let's just investigate whether or not we're really seeing this job polarization. Is it actually true at all that we're seeing this rise of low-end jobs, rise of high-end jobs, and hollowing out of the middle? Here's the interesting thing. It was happening in the 80s and the 90s. It's not super strong. Like, there was still growth in middle-wage jobs in both of those decades, but you do see this U shape. It's not strong, but it's a detectable degree of job polarization in the 80s and the 90s, and then it stopped. It's not happening in the 2000s. It is no longer a way to describe the U.S. labor market. Job polarization, just we're not seeing it happening once the 90s ended. So that's one thing that it used to be a good descriptor of a decent descriptor of the U.S. labor market, but not anymore. And then the other thing is, it was never driving wage trends. Even in the 80s and the 90s, when we were seeing some of this U-shape, this job polarization and employment growth, those employment trends didn't match up with the wage trends that we see. So that idea of job polarization, it's not happening now. And it was never very helpful in helping us understand what's going on with wage trends, and in particular, rising wage inequality.
Parenthetically, when I was looking at this, the fast food workers campaign, I was looking at fast food wages and discovered there's something at the 10th or 15th percentile of the wage distribution. I think there's a lot of people who think that this is the typical job for a lot of the working class, but it is really not so much, is it?
Yes, you're exactly right. So those fast food jobs occupy the lowest rungs on the wage ladder of U.S. jobs. So they will often have wages that are at or near minimum wage. The federal minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. So you'll have these jobs will sort of be near that level. So very low on the, if you look at the distribution of wages in our economy, they're occupying that lowest rung. So just to put it in perspective, right now the median wage, the typical wage of the person whose wages, if you wind everyone up from lowest wage to highest wage, the person in the middle right now is making about $16.50 an hour. So these fast food jobs are, you know, where you're making $8, $9 an hour are far below what the typical person in the United States is making.
Okay, now, all right, back to your work. Now, economists, well, and even politicians will tell you, and pundits, that the problem is that the economy is generating jobs, but we just don't have the right workforce for it. People lack the skills. So it's all about education. What do you say to that?
Doesn't show up in the data. So it is true that we have had higher and higher demand over time for workers with greater and greater skills. But that's been going on forever. Throughout this country's entire history, we've seen education and skill upgrading. It's still happening. You know, we have, every year, we have more, a bigger and bigger share of young people graduating from college. So we're seeing this educational and skills upgrading over time, and it's pretty much matching the increased demand for workers with skills. So we have increased demand for workers with higher levels of skills and education, and the workforce is also achieving higher levels of skills and education. So that has been going on forever. And so that is, it's really hard to use that to try to explain the rising wage inequality that we've just seen since the 70s. Because we saw that dynamic of increased need for workers with skills and increasing skills of the labor force in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s when we did not see rising wage inequality. And then in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, we're seeing that same phenomenon, but we are also seeing rising wage inequality. So what that underscores is the U.S. workforce not having the right skills is not what is driving this new, relatively new, since the 70s, trend in massively increasing wage inequality. And another, maybe an even more intuitive way to say that is you see a ton of increase in wage inequality happening within people with the same education level. So yes, people with a bachelor's degree make more money than people without a bachelor's degree on average, but over time, the inequality within people who have a master's or who have a bachelor's degree. So the inequality has grown dramatically if you just focus on people with a bachelor's degree. So if you just focus on people with a certain level of education, so you're sort of stripping out this issue that of educational upgrading, we've seen wage inequality happen within every single education group. So what that means is that there's something else going on. It's not that workers don't have the right skills or education.
Yeah, I remember reading a paper back in the 90s that put it this way, that if you sort the population into cells by similar demographic characteristics, education, age, race, gender, region, whatever, there was an increase in both within cells inequality, an increase in inequality between cells. So the both of these phenomena are happening at the same time. How does that compare to what is going on now?
So that's still true. The interesting thing on education is that between difference has really stopped. The increase in the between, and I'll say this in a more intuitive way, kind of stopped around 2000. So one way to say this is that the college premium was increasing dramatically over the 80s and the 90s. In other words, people with a college degree made more than people with, say, a high school degree. But it was growing and growing and growing, so the returns to college were high and they were increasing over time. Since the 2000s, it's really leveled off. That we haven't, you make more money if you go to college, but the returns to college aren't increasing. It's sort of that you're no longer making relative gains compared to those with a high school degree, so that the increase in inequality since then is not due to this people having different levels of education. It's not due to the between thing. It's within. It's increasing inequality within those with a college degree and within those at other levels of education.
And you're saying in the paper that there's been no serious occupational job polarization over the last decade or so. What do you mean by that? Could you expand on that?
Idea that we're having, low-end jobs growing, high-end jobs growing, and the hollowing out of the middle, it's not true right now. It's not true since the 90s. So it's an L shape now. We are seeing disproportionate growth at the low end. So there's been some disproportionate growth in lower-wage jobs, But not a ton. It's one of the things we found in this paper is this narrative that the low-end jobs were really growing strongly in the business cycle from 2000 to 2007. A lot of that was driven by coding problems in government data sets. Every 10 years or so, they actually have to recode how they identify occupations because there's occupations, we have changes in our economy. There's occupations that are coming into being that weren't there before, and there's occupations that are going away that weren't. We sort of always have this evolution in the labor market. It's totally normal. It's been going on forever. It will continue going on going forward. So every once in a while, they have to redo the way that our government statistical agencies have to redo the way they code occupations. There's a big coding break in the middle of the 2000s that gave the appearance of a big increase in low-wage occupation growth that once you account for that coding change, a lot of that goes away. So there was disproportionate growth in low-wage jobs in the 2000s, but it's not that strong, and there was very little change in the employment shares for middle-wage jobs and high-wage jobs. So you sort of see some growth, disproportionate growth at the bottom, but it's not too extreme, and middle-wage jobs and high-wage jobs just sort of remaining pretty flat. So just no evidence of this nice U shape, this hollowing out of the middle. The middle class is getting, you know, we see wages and incomes taking a big hit, but it is just not being driven by this idea of job polarization.
The income distribution started getting more unequal in the early 1970s. It's been fairly steadily so since. What can you say about how the causes of that polarization have changed over time? Is, you know, this occupational story fit any of the earlier periods?
There's an interesting evolution of how this all happened. It was the 1980s was the first decade where we really saw a big increase in wage inequality. And what you saw, how the way that happened was low-wage jobs saw big losses, middle-wage jobs held about steady, and high-wage jobs saw big gains. So you saw wages sort of growing more the higher wages that you had. That's where this idea of, and I'm going to say this very technical phrase, skill bias technical change was born. Skill bias technical change is the term that economists use to say, look, the more skills you have, the more rewarded you are in the labor market. That actually could explain those trends in the 80s. But then we got to the 90s, and the wage trends looked different. Wage inequality still grew in the 90s. You still saw people at the very top see extremely high gains, but the people at the very bottom saw bigger wage gains than the people at the middle. And this idea of skill bias technical change couldn't explain that. It had no explanation for the fact that the people at the bottom saw higher wage growth than the people at the middle. So that's when this idea of job polarization was born. People thought, okay, it's sort of a way to rescue this idea that technology, that skills are still driving wage trends in the labor market. If you say that, oh, it's because low-wage jobs are growing relative to middle-wage jobs. But then when you dig into the data, you find that the timing just actually doesn't work out, that you don't see stronger wage growth in the occupations that had stronger employment growth. And so it's just not, it's on the face of it, the patterns look the same, but when you dig in, the link is very weak, and then again, it's just not happening at all in the 2000s.
I'm speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who's a staff economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and co-author of their paper, Don't Blame the Robots. Now, we're also, there are different kinds of polarization, different kinds of inequality. So if you compare people to 50th percentile, the middle of the distribution, with people to 10th percentile, very close to the bottom, that has been evolving in different way from what's happened with people to very, near the top, the 90th percentile versus the 50th, right? So what's been going on with those middle to bottom versus top to middle ratios?
Yeah, this is a super interesting point. So people say, rising wage inequality, we all sort of know that that is happening, and it is. But the underlying dynamics are interesting, and that's what you're talking about. Where economists will talk about upper tail inequality or lower tail inequality. So it's rising wage inequality can take the form of the top pulling away from the middle or the middle pulling away from the bottom is one way to kind of deconstruct it. In the 80s, you saw upper tail and lower tail inequality rising. The top was pulling away from the middle and the middle was pulling away from the bottom. So across the distribution, you saw rising wage inequality. The 90s were a little different. The top pulled away from the middle, but the bottom did relatively well. The bottom, that 50-10 ratio, the ratio of the wage of the middle to the bottom, did not rise in the 90s. And that's the thing, actually, that this job polarization theory originally held the promise of explaining. It turns out it doesn't have much power to explain that, but that was what the original promise that it held. It turns out, in my opinion, that what I think was going on in the 90s, where you saw the bottom doing a lot, actually growing more than the middle, so you did not see lower tail inequality rising in the 90s, had a lot to do with there was an increase in the minimum wage in the 90s. So you pull up the bottom, you pull up the very bottom, that means the bottom does better than the middle. And then the labor market got very, very tight at the end of the 90s. That was this extraordinary period in the United States labor market where in the year 1999 and 2000, over those 2 years, the unemployment rate averaged 4.1%. It was just, we got to extraordinarily tight labor markets. That actually really helps people at the very bottom. When you have low unemployment, when you have tight labor markets, it actually increases the wages across the board. Even high-wage people make more when the unemployment rate is very low than they otherwise would. So it helps people across the board, but it helps people at the bottom the most. They are the most, they benefit the most from very tight labor markets. So that was the other thing that was really buoying wages at the very bottom in the 90s and why we did not see the lower tail inequality increase.
That was those 4 or 5 years of the late 90s were the only time out of the last 40, really, where just about every demographic group saw substantial wage increases.
Yeah, that's right. So, and the unique thing that happened in that period was the very tight labor markets. So all of the other things that were contributing to rising wage inequality since the 70s were still there. We still had, well, the minimum wage did rise, but we still had globalization happening in a way that exposed our low and middle wage workers to extremely competition from extremely low paid workers around the globe. We still hadn't, at that point, the dollar was becoming more and more overvalued. We had, there are things going on that were still pushing against wage growth of low wage workers, but those tight labor markets made all the difference. And the intuition is really straightforward. You could see it in the opposite way right now. Unemployment is so high, and that really hurts wage growth. The intuition being, if your employer knows you don't have any outside options, they do not have to pay wage increases to keep you. They know you're not going anywhere. That's what's going on now. That's one of the reasons wages are so depressed right now. The opposite was happening in the late 90s. We had very tight labor markets. Your employer knows you have a ton of outside options. If they don't increase your job quality through increases in wages, other fringe benefits, but you can just quit and go next door where you're going to get offered a better compensation package. And so those tight labor markets made a huge difference across the board, but particularly at the very low end.
It's funny to read Federal Reserve transcripts of that period because they're actually worried about this. This was an object of concern. They were swapping stories of extraordinary bonuses that were being paid for signing new workers. So they didn't like that.
No, yeah. In some corners, wage growth is a sign of things overheating. And what we want to make sure that inflation doesn't go out of control, but we had this period of extremely tight labor markets when wages were growing strongly and inflation was absolutely, totally under control. So we weren't seeing the bad effects that those people that you were talking about were worried about. So it can, we can absolutely have a situation where there's tight labor markets, strong wage growth, and the economy is not overheating. It's going fine. It's just we are will be fully using our productive potential. We are very far away from that right now, but it's that period in the late 90s helped show that it was really possible.
Your paper doesn't really address this, but your argument is that the data do not support the, both the popular and academic arguments about occupational polarization leading to income polarization. What then is the driving force? What's been going on?
Right, that's a fine question. In the first iteration of this paper, we had like a 5-page addendum that tried to get into that, but we realized it was it's too big of a story to try to do quickly, because there's not one thing. It's not you actually can't say this is the one thing that led to rising wage inequality over this period. It was a host of policy choices that led to the wage and income dynamics that we have seen in this country since the 70s. So some of them I've mentioned, like the declining real value of the minimum wage. The, you know, it's been re-upped every once in a while, the minimum wage has, but it still has never gotten back to its the high value it had in real terms in the late 60s. Unionization has dropped. And importantly, there's been a big decline in the unionization rate of people who say they want to be in a union. So what we care about is that people who want to be in a union are able to be in a union. And one of the things that has changed there, it's more of an act of omission rather than commission, is labor law has not kept up with increased employer aggressiveness in fighting union drive. So there's a whole industry now that an employer who's facing a union drive can turn to help them fight that union drive, that industry that did not used to exist. And labor law just has not kept up with those changes. You have, not right now, now we're in an extraordinary period, and the Fed is, you know, doing many things to try to bring the unemployment rate down. But think pre-recession, from the period, from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and the 2000s before the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve Board, contrary to what they had done before the 70s, was much more placed much more emphasis on price stability, i.e. low inflation, instead of low unemployment. And with the exception of this period of the late 90s, where for other reasons the Fed really let the unemployment rate get low, outside of that period, they had sort of very conservative targets for the unemployment rate, and they often missed them. So they just weren't emphasizing low unemployment. And as I said, that really hurts low-wage workers more. And the other big thing, so the labor market institutions like minimum wage and unionization, the Fed not prioritizing full employment. The other big thing I think that's in there that needs mentioning is globalization. Globalization, trade agreements done in a way that exposes low and moderate income American workers to competition from extremely low paid workers around the globe while protecting the incomes of the sort of top swath of earners in the U.S. through things like patent laws and copyrights. The term free trade is such a misnomer because you'll have it be free with respect to exposing our workers to competition from low-paid workers around the globe, but not free at all with respect to things like, you know, patents and copyright protection. Those are labor market interventions. Those a copyright is not about free trade. A patent is not about free trade. So the way globalization is done is has been done is the freeness of it has really been applied unequally, and that's also led to increasing inequality.
Yeah, just a final footnote on your point about unions. The increase in within occupation and within education grouping inequality That's the kind of thing that unions tend to compress, isn't it?
That's right, right. So you have pay scales that are just less compressed, or more compressed than what you would see in non-union shops. And so a higher share of a workforce in a union can lead to rising equality in that way. And another thing that you see is this union spillover effect, where when you have a decent share of a given area or industry that is unionized, the wage setting that happens in that union can actually spill over to non-union shops. It just sort of becomes, that's the way it's done. And so you can see the effects of that having much larger impact than just on the unionized workers themselves. So it has these benefits that are even broader than just what's happening within unionized places.
That was Heidi Schierholz, a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and co-author of a new paper called Don't Blame the Robots, Assessing the Job Polarization Explanation of Growing Inequality. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the fourth sketch for piano by Bella Bartok, performed by Yano Yondo. Till next week, bye.